This is a recording from the New Dominion Bookshop, brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit us at cvillepodcast.com for more radio shows, features, and speeches. James Collins is a former editor at Time Magazine and has contributed to The New Yorker, among other magazines. He grew up in New York City, but he and his family now call Charlottesville home. Collins spoke at New Dominion Bookshop on January 15, 2008, to discuss his first novel, Beginner's Greek.
Thank you. It's really great to be here. First thing I wanted to say was how honored and proud I am to be at this bookstore, because it is such an unbelievable bookstore. It is like the greatest bookstore really I know about, truly, right now at least. There were a couple years ago in New York, there were some that were maybe almost as good, and they've closed. So as far as bookstores go, this is the really amazing one. And I was going to mention that one time, not so long ago, I was here, and the front, very first set of books, the shelves, are poetry, and then there's some music. And I bought The Strength of Poetry, which is a group of essays by James Fenton, who's a poet and essayist, and a book of modern French poets, and something, a collection of poetry, an anthology that was selected by Seamus Heaney and Ted Hughes, and also a biography of Bunny Berrigan, who some of you may know was a big band leader in the 30s. And I had not gotten beyond about 3 feet in the store when I already had all those books, which you would never find anywhere else, and you would never know about to buy on Amazon, because you just wouldn't know they existed. So anyway, if you're out there, Carol, thank you, and thank you for having this wonderful store. Maybe I will just, it's sort of boring, but I just will maybe read a little bit just from the beginning, because this is my second time of doing this. And the first time it was 5 people who are old friends, 3 people from the book publisher, and 1 actual civilian. So so I'll just read for maybe 10 minutes or so. I'll start my stopwatch. All right, well, it starts with a prologue. When Peter Russell boarded an airplane, he always wondered whether he would sit next to a beautiful young woman during the flight, and if so, whether he and she would fall in love. This time was no different, except for his conviction that, this time, it really would happen. Of course, he always believed more than ever that this time it really would happen. But he knew. He was working his way down the aisle of a plane bound for Los Angeles from New York, and he figured, realistically, that the occurrence he envisioned would more likely take place on a long trip. He was pleased to discover that on his side of the plane, the rows had only 2 seats, an arrangement that would promote intimacy. And arriving at his assigned place, he found that his roommate had not yet appeared, which would allow his mind to savor the possibilities for at least a few more minutes. He stowed his suit jacket, briefcase, and laptop, and settled into his seat by the window. He opened his paper and then looked to his right, regarding the pregnant emptiness beside him. The clasp and buckle of the seatbelt lay there impassively, indifferent to whom they would soon embrace. He looked at the scratchy gray and red upholstery with its abstract design that vaguely recalled clouds at sunset. Peter remembered being at dinner in college one time and listening to an incredibly pretentious jerk, his best friend, impress everyone with some stuff from the highly selective English seminar he was taking. Something about how absence implies presence. And this is a parenthesis with a quotation, so I guess I shouldn't worry about cutting class so much. Close parenthesis. General laughter, jerk. Well, Peter had to admit, the most prominent thing about the throne of absence beside him was the presence that it lacked. A man wearing a beige shirt and jacket stopped at Peter's row. He was short and Eastern European looking, and had a small mustache. He looked at the stub of his boarding pass, and at the row number and back again, and moved on. Peter was relieved. But who knew? Anyone who sat with him might transform his life in ways he would never expect. The man coming down the aisle, the one with the bulldog face and gold tie clasp, might be the owner of a smelting concern in Buffalo. And he might take a shine to Peter and ask him to become a vice president. And Peter might say yes and move to Buffalo, where he would find the people more complicated than he expected, and where, in an appealing way, The grime would climb like ivy up the walls of the old brick buildings. He would marry someone nice who had worked in New York for a couple of years, but preferred Buffalo and being near her companionable, well-off parents, and he and she would live in a spacious Victorian house with several old trees whose leaves in summer were as big as dinner plates. But what about the ancient, bent-over gentleman in the three-piece suit? Couldn't he be a great-uncle who had disappeared in Burma decades ago and about whom Peter had never heard but whose identity would be revealed when Peter noticed that his ring bore the same distinctive device as one owned by Peter's grandfather? He would leave Peter his fortune. The Thai-class man walked past Peter. The ancient one sat before reaching him. Most passengers seemed to have boarded by now. Yet Peter felt a tingle. Something he knew was about to happen. Yes, definitely. A young woman was going to sit down next to him, and not just a young woman, the young woman. A really pretty, really kind young woman. And they would get to talking, and they would become enclosed in their pair of seats in a kind of pod within a pod, suspended far above the earth, and by the time they landed, it all would be settled and clear. More happy, happy love. Naturally, he had given this individual a lot of thought. He would add and subtract her attributes. She would be pretty and kind, then pretty and kind and smart, then pretty and kind and smart and funny, and in a general way, perfect. Was that too much to hope? He very well knew that it was. He knew that real people with whom one really shared a real life in the real world had flaws. Aren't the slubs and natural variations what give a fabric its special character? Yes, but he didn't want to fall in love with the fabric. He wanted to fall in love with a young woman who was pretty and kind and smart and funny and, well, pretty and kind would do if only she would fall in love with him. Peter stared out the window. A truck was pumping fuel into the plane's belly through a thick umbilical hose. Peter was a happy fellow, basically. He was in his early 20s, and he was good-looking, with an open face and light brown eyes and fine brown hair that flopped over his forehead. He stood a shade under 6 feet, and had a strong, medium-sized frame. He liked his job, basically, and he was doing well. He had friends. He was a decent athlete. He had had a relatively happy childhood, but this love business. So far, it had not been very satisfying. He had been involved with girls he liked. He had been involved with girls he didn't like. In either case, had he ever really felt whatever it was that he imagined he was supposed to feel? He was shy. So that even though he showed determination at work and playing hockey, he positively enjoyed giving an opponent a hard check, he shrank before a girl who attracted him. And this made the search for someone who would make him feel whatever it was he was supposed to feel even particularly difficult. Moreover, he wasn't cold-blooded, so he couldn't pursue and abandon girls with the same relish as some of his friends, his best friend in particular. Rather, he had a sympathetic streak that, in the matter of making conquests, seemed much more like a weakness than a strength. Peter watched a crewman begin to uncouple the fuel hose. Then he felt a presence, with a capital P. It was a female, he sensed. Could this be the very one? Could this be she, capital S? He turned his head and did see a woman. A woman who was perhaps 70 years old, wearing a black wig. In place of eyebrows, she had two arched pencil lines, and she had applied a large clown's oval of red lipstick to her mouth. Peter's eyes met hers. Her false eyelashes reminded him of tarantula legs. My darling. What row is this? The woman asked him. Peter told her. She looked at her boarding pass and threw up her hands. Ah, she said, my row doesn't exist. They skipped it. I have the plane where they skip rows. If my son would visit me, I would avoid this aggravation. But no, the wife gets dehydrated on the plane. Dehydrated, you know, water. She looked hard at Peter. Are you married? She asked. He shook his head. Marry a nice girl. She paused a moment to make sure this advice sank in, and then turned around and headed back toward the front of the plane. Peter could see no other passengers in the aisle. A flight attendant strode by, closing luggage bins. Peter listened to the engines. Any minute now, the plane would begin to pull away from the gate, and the monitors drooping from the ceiling would begin to play the safety video. Peter looked at the empty seat beside him. His earlier agitation and euphoria had dissipated, replaced by a hangover of irrational disappointment. He looked at the seatbelt, two lifeless arms embracing no one. Of course, all that could be inferred from absence was absence. He now knew who would sit beside him. Nobody.
You're listening to James Collins reading from his first novel, Beginner's Greek, at New Dominion Bookshop on January 15, 2008. Collins next took questions from the audience. The first person asked Collins if the writing came easily to him.
Actually, it's funny. I was in journalism, as the bio says, and I never was a fast or easy writer. I was always a bit. It was always a bit agonizing, and I always had to. I procrastinated, and even in college, writing papers was difficult. But this actually was a lot of. It was almost purely fun. I mean, there were times of real frustration, but when I didn't know what I was going to do, or some problem that I didn't know how to solve. But overall, the actual writing itself was very enjoyable, and was actually. I mean, I wouldn't say easy, but it came pretty. Pretty well. I felt every day I made progress, and so I was shocked because it was not agony. It wasn't blood dripping out every day to get the pages written, and that was great. That kept me going a lot.
Another audience member asked if Collins would be quitting his day job.
Well, this sort of was paying my day job. I was sort of freelancing, and then I decided I was never going to get this done because it was going to take me 9 months to do it. And that 9 months ended, and then it was going to take me 3 months to do it. And every 3 months, I would say, it's going to take me another 3 months. And that got into years, and so I finally figured I really just got to do this only in order to get it through. And the reason it took so long was because it was not because it was hard. It was because it was actually so much fun. It got longer and longer and longer and longer and longer, and there were lots of digressions and subplots and endless things that were too much fun to write to not write, but which had to go. Unless someone said to me, "Oh, it's the kind of book you don't want to have end," and I wanted to say, "Well, guess what? I've got the special. I've got your own. I've got the manuscript. I've got the manuscript for you, which is 2/3 again as long." But anyway, I ended up just concentrating on it solely.
Collins was asked if his previous work in The New Yorker and other magazines was in a similar vein, employing humor.
Oh, they were all nonfiction. This is the first fiction I've done.
Humor?
Yes, often with humor. Some humor, and I guess in all of them, although some of them are pretty straight. But actually, that's not true. When I was working for Time Magazine, I was an editor there, but I also wrote some. Those had no humor. Those were very straight. But before then, and for The New Yorker, there was a little bit of humor, even in the reported nonfiction. Somebody asked me whether, actually, the one other time I'd done this, somebody asked, "Were you sitting there laughing while you were writing it?" And I thought to myself, God, it hadn't occurred to me. There are a couple of lines that I have to confess, still secretly, just between us, I get a little kick out. I think of and I remember and I sort of laugh at. But generally, no, I was not. It was, enjoyable, but I was working away.
Another person asked if Collins drew on his own life experiences for his novel.
It's just saying, Barclay, this actually, the very first incident actually happened to me. What happens a little later on is that, guess what, a beautiful, sympathetic girl does sit down next to him. And then that's why you get the next 460 pages, because if that didn't happen, obviously it would end there. And she's reading The Magic Mountain, and so they sort of bond over that. And actually, it literally happened to me when I was in my early 20s. I was on a flight from New York to Los Angeles, and I was sitting in the plane, and a very pretty, even beautiful young woman sat next to me, and she was reading The Magic Mountain. She actually was somebody who I knew slightly, and it didn't work out the way. There were not 460 more pages of that. In this book, she's on about page 500, which is impressive. And I have to say that this woman was on about page six, which was a little less impressive for that book, but it did actually happen. So that was one of those.
Someone asked Collins if he were planning a sequel to Beginner's Greek.
So the start of the next book, and there are a couple of little elements that are, it's growing out from, and it's quite, it's a bit different. And this is also going to take me only 9 months to write. It's going to be, it's a short, I have an idea of it being quite short.
Another person asks Collins who his influences are.
Well, I guess, you know, it's funny. I keep on thinking of only English people, and maybe that's because of this particular kind of book this is, but people have very, very flatteringly compared it to Jane Austen, which is very nice. In some ways, it's not very much like Jane Austen, although there are elements. So, but certainly she, for this kind of a book, which was a big influence, Waugh, E.M. Forster, Trollope, or some of the people who I can think of who, not that I am, who laughed, my wife. I recognize that snort. I'm not comparing myself to them. You asked me for influences, not people who, yeah. And so people like that, but I guess for this one, not really a lot of American, I can't really think of American writers who I like, but who was sort of were people who I thought of or were the back of my mind for this particular kind of thing, which is, you know, people also call it a comedy of manners, which is it is kind of, and the tone of it and the style of it is more, I have, Kingsley Amis is another example, that kind of comic novel, that kind of writer is more who, I guess, consciously or unconsciously was in my mind.
Collins read from another portion of the novel.
He looked at the seatbelt, two lifeless arms embracing no one. Of course, all that could be inferred from absence was absence. He now knew who would sit beside him. Nobody. Peter sighed and shrugged his shoulders. Then, like a depressive, pulling the covers over his head, he spread open his paper so that it surrounded him and began to read a story with the headline, Council Rebuffs Mayor on Wake Zones Measure. It was quite interesting, actually. There was an effort to slow watercraft to prevent damage to shoreline structures, like Venice. Peter had been reading for a couple of minutes when he heard some rushed footsteps coming toward him. The light, tripping footsteps, he noted, of a young person, most likely a female young person. Then, when they had seemed to reach his row, the footsteps stopped. Peter became aware of a form hovering by. But because of his newspaper, he couldn't see who it was. He nonchalantly folded the paper back, glanced to his right, and saw that a young woman was hoisting a bag overhead. As she lifted her arms, she revealed a tanned, well-modeled stripe of abdomen. Peter's heart fluttered. He concentrated on his paper. And this is in quotes, it's another headline. In New South, courthouse towns see change, continuity. The young woman sat down. As well as he could, while pretending to idly look around the cabin, Peter studied her. She appeared to be Peter's age. She wore a thin white cardigan and blue jeans. What Peter first noticed in her profile was the soft bow of her jaw and how the line turned back at her rounded chin. It reminded Peter of an ideal curve that might be displayed in an old painting manual. His eye traveled back along the jaw, returning to the girl's ear. It was a small ear, beige in color, that appeared almost edible, like a biscuit. Her straight nose had a finely tooled knob at the end, and her forehead rose like the side of an overturned bowl. Her complexion was as smooth and warm-toned as honey. As to her form, she was lanky, with long legs and arms and thin wrists. Her long neck held her head aloft. Now the young woman turned in Peter's direction, looking for the clasp on her seatbelt, the trapezoid created by her shoulders and her narrow waist, the roundness of her bosom, the working of her fingers, so long they seemed like individual limbs, all moved him deeply. Then she raised her head, looked at him, and smiled. The effect was like seeing the sun over the ocean at mid-morning, a tremendous blast of light. It was as if the young woman had raised some mythic golden shield whose brilliance would prostrate the armies of the Hittites. She had an oval face, and her large eyes were set wide apart. They were green as a green flame. Peter instructed the muscles at the corners of his mouth to retract in a friendly way, with a hint of flirtatiousness. He imagined the result was like the grimace of someone breathing mustard gas. The girl nodded and looked away, buckling her seatbelt and settling herself in. Before she sat down, Peter noticed, she had thrown a thick paperback onto her seat. He hadn't been able to see the title. Now she opened it and began to read. In her left hand, she held back a thick wedge of pages, about two-thirds of the book. After a moment, Peter saw out of the corner of his eye that she had let go with her left hand, and the book had fallen closed. She sat staring before her, lost in thought. Peter saw the book's cover and was taken aback. The Magic Mountain by Thomas Mann. To sit next to a beautiful young woman on a flight from New York to Los Angeles is one thing. To sit next to a beautiful young woman on a flight from New York to Los Angeles who was on page 500 of The Magic Mountain is quite another. If you look over to see what the beautiful young woman next to you is reading and it turns out to be a book about angels, then you can with perfect justification refuse her entry into your life. What could you possibly have to say to each other? The same logic applies even if the book is more respectable but basically dumb, a harrowing but ultimately life-affirming memoir. And if the book is utterly respectable but still basically dumb, say the new book by a fashionable, overrated English novelist, then the young woman is especially dismissible, since the worst alternative possible is talking to someone who thinks she is clever but isn't. At the same time, if she were reading something that showed that she was really extremely smart, a computer science journal, then there would be no point in talking to her either. She'd be far too intimidating. In sum, an argument could be derived from virtually any reading matter that would allow a young man scared out of his wits to persuade himself that it was perfectly sensible, rather than the height of cowardice, to ignore the beautiful young woman who would be sitting next to him for the following 5 hours. Any reading that matter, that is, except The Magic Mountain by Thomas Mann. A beautiful young woman reading the Magic Mountain. How could he weasel out of this challenge? It was a serious book, but not one suited to a preening intellectual, who would prefer one that was more difficult and less dodgy. A young woman reading The Magic Mountain had to be intelligent and patient and interested in a range of different ideas, many of them quite old-fashioned. She would also happen to be reading the only long German novel that Peter Russell himself had ever read. Needless to say, for all his daydream eagerness, now that he was actually presented with the possibility of falling in love with the beautiful young woman sitting next to him on an airplane, Peter was terrified. Terrified that he might actually get what he dreamt of getting, and terrified that now, having the opportunity to get it, he would screw up. If he did not find some way to speak to this young woman and charm her, he would kill himself. If he spoke to her and she, without even looking at him, gathered her belongings and moved to another seat, he would also kill himself. The plane had taken off by this time and drifted slowly, slowly, as it seemed, above a thick wadding of cloud. The sound of the engines was loud, but had become familiar and functioned as thought-extinguishing white noise. Peter was hanging in the air, and for 5 hours, essentially nothing would change. The unvariegated membrane of time that stretched before him would be dimpled only when the flight attendant handed him a beverage and a packet of pretzels. Yet, and nevertheless, notwithstanding all this inertia, tremendous forces of potential energy were gathered in this setting, for without even speaking to her, Peter was convinced, he knew for a certainty, he had not the slightest doubt, that he could spend the rest of his life with the young woman who had happened to sit next to him, and it would be blissful. He could tell this not simply on account of her appearance or the book she read, but because of the way she held the book in her hands, the way she tilted her head, the way she lightly set her lips together. All this provided more than enough evidence of her kindness, devotion, wisdom, grace, wit, and capacity for love. Never in his experience had he learned more about a woman's character after thorough and often quite unpleasant explorations of it than he had already known within 30 seconds of meeting her. With men, he had discovered you needed 5 seconds. And now he heard the voice of emotional maturity explain to him patronizingly that his assumptions about this woman were based on a fantasy. Real life, real marriage involves a commitment to a real person with all her flaws and individual needs. A real life together was doing the dishes when you were tired and paying the mortgage. He stole another glance at the young woman. He imagined her thumb and forefinger grasping a ballpoint pen and writing out a mortgage check, her hand working like some antique mechanism that was a marvel to the world. Bring on the dishes. So, as we have seen, however inert the setting might seem to be, tremendous forces were gathered in the cabin of this aircraft. Forces, tremendous ones. Peter knew that with the smallest effort, he could potentiate the situation with epical consequences for his life and happiness. It was as if the entire cabin were filled with the tasteless, odorless fumes of powerful romantic sexual gas, and only a spark was needed to create an explosion. The plane would suffer no damage. The other passengers wouldn't even notice, but the result would change his life. What would that spark be? Peter was not one of those people who easily strike up conversations with strangers. If there were a subset of that group from which he was even more decisively excluded, it would be that which consists of men who easily strike up conversations with strangers who are pretty girls. His best friend was able to meet the eyes of a girl in line at the party, at the movies, and smile and casually say something like, "So, do you think this really is as good as his last one?" Then they'd be off and running. Peter, meanwhile, expected to address the girl's friend, would stand by, mute. The young woman sighed, shifted in her seat, stretched a little, and looked up. Here was his moment. He could look over and ask, "What takes you to Los Angeles?" He could say that. "What takes you to Los Angeles?" The words circled around and around in his head like the tigers who turned to butter. "What takes you to Los Angeles? What takes you to Los Angeles? What takes you to Los Angeles?" He became almost dizzy with their silent repetition. Then something strange happened. This was very odd. Peter was not prone to auditory hallucinations, but he thought that he actually heard the words, "What takes you to Los Angeles?" being spoken aloud. Suddenly understanding, he jumped in his seat. "Oh, I'm sorry," he heard a warm mezzo voice say. "I didn't mean to startle you. I was just wondering, what takes you to Los Angeles?" The young woman had spoken to him, and Peter looked at her in her mild, friendly expression. He noticed, as he had not before, how her philtrum rhymed with a shallow cleft in her chin. It was time for him to say something. He was looking at her. She was looking at him, with that mild expression of conversational invitation. His brain clicked and whirred and blinked. Finally, he managed to say, "Work," more accurately transcribed as "Girk." Now Peter braced himself for the inevitable. "What sort of work do you do?" "New wave, West Coast jazz pianist. Vintner, assassin." No, he would have to say that he worked for a Wall Street firm and right now was in the corporate finance department, and therefore was the most boring human being you could possibly meet on the plane flying to Los Angeles. "Corporate finance, my God. Well, you see, right now we're issuing some convertible debt for a mid-sized bank." In fact, there were aspects of it that were interesting to him, but no regular human being, and certainly no beautiful young woman, would ever want to have a conversation about such a subject or believe that a person so employed was worth talking to about anything. He would tell her what he did, and the remaining 4 hours and 50 minutes of the flight would pass in silence. But the young woman didn't ask about his job. Instead, she asked, "Do you like Los Angeles? Do you like Los Angeles?" Another impossible question. He knew that the accepted thing was to hold L.A. in contempt. Still, you couldn't act too proud of yourself for bashing the place, since that was so conventional. If you made a smug rise crack about it, "Breast implants, those people need brain implants," you risk sounding like a very tiresome person eager to beat a horse that had already been turned to dust. You couldn't actually say you liked L.A., could you? What pressure. Pro, con, funny, serious, knowing, naive, good, bad, yes, no, zero, one, up, down, back, forth. He toggled between responses and finally produced a sort of ingenious synthesis. "L.A. is all right."
You've been listening to James Collins reading from his first novel, Beginner's Greek. The reading took place at the New Dominion Bookshop on January 15, 2008. This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit us at seavillepodcast.com.